Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for October 4, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. The headline on the front page reads, McCarthy ousted. Speaker becomes first in history to be voted from the job. Speaker Kevin McCarthy was voted out of the job Tuesday in an extraordinary showdown, a first in U.S. history, forced by a contingent of hard-right conservatives and throwing the House and its Republican leadership into chaos. McCarthy, who repeatedly said he never gives up, found himself with almost no options. Neither the right-flank Republicans who engineered his ouster nor the Democrats seemed open to negotiating. McCarthy told lawmakers in the evening that he would not run again for Speaker, putting the gavel up for grabs. Next steps are uncertain, as there is no obvious successor to lead the House Republican majority. Action is halted in the House until next week, when Republicans will try to elect a new Speaker. I may have lost this vote today, but as I walk out of this chamber, I feel fortunate to have served, McCarthy said at a news conference at the Capitol. I wouldn't change a thing. McCarthy's chief rival, Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida, orchestrated the rare vote on the obscure motion to vacate and pushed ahead swiftly into a dramatic afternoon roll call. While McCarthy enjoyed support from most Republicans in his slim majority, 8 GOP detractors, many of the same hard-right holdouts who tried to stop him from becoming Speaker in January, essentially forced him out. Stillness fell as the presiding officer gaveled the vote closed, 216-210, saying the office of the Speaker is hereby declared vacant. Moments later, McCarthy ally Representative Patrick McHenry, a Republican from North Carolina, took the gavel and, according to House rules, was named Speaker Pro Tempore, or Speaker Pro Tem, to serve in the office until a new Speaker is chosen. The House then briskly recessed as lawmakers prepared to meet privately and discuss the path forward. Many lined up to hug McCarthy, some to shake his hand. It was a stunning moment for McCarthy, a punishment fueled by growing grievances but sparked by his weekend decision to work with Democrats to keep the federal government open rather than risk a shutdown. In many ways, McCarthy's ouster was set in motion in deal-making with hard-right holdouts at the start of the year, when he agreed to demands that included a rules change to allow a single lawmaker to file the motion to vacate. Gaetz, a top ally of Donald Trump, rose to offer his motion. Leaders tried to turn it back, but the vote was 218-208, with 11 Republicans against tabling the motion. The House then opened a floor debate, and Republicans argued publicly for more than an hour. It's a sad day, Republican Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma said as debate got underway, urging his colleagues not to plunge the House Republicans' majority into chaos. But Gaetz shot back, chaos is Speaker McCarthy. Many of the complaints against the Speaker revolved around his truthfulness and ability to keep promises he made. Gaetz criticized the debt deal McCarthy made with President Joe Biden and the vote to prevent a government shutdown, which conservatives opposed as they demanded steeper spending cuts. McCarthy supporters stood up for him, including Representative Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, a leader of the Conservative Freedom Caucus. Representative Garrett Graves, Republican from Louisiana, waved his cell phone, saying it was disgusting that hard-right colleagues were fundraising off the move in text messages seeking donations. McCarthy of California insisted he would not cut a deal with Democrats to remain in power. Not that he could have relied on their help even if he had asked. Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a letter to colleagues that he wants to work with Republicans, but was unwilling to provide the votes needed to save McCarthy. It is now the responsibility of the GOP members to end the House Republican Civil War, Jeffries said, announcing the Democratic leadership would vote for the motion to oust the Speaker. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said Biden hopes the House will quickly elect a Speaker. Once that happens, she said, he looks forward to working together with them. At the Capitol, both Republicans and Democrats met privately ahead of the historic vote. Behind closed doors, McCarthy told fellow Republicans, "Let's get on with it." He invoked Republican Speaker Joseph Cannon, who more than 100 years ago called his critics bluff and set the vote himself on his ouster. Cannon survived that takedown attempt, the first time the House actually voted to consider removing its Speaker. Across the way, in the Capitol, Democrats unified around one common point. McCarthy cannot be trusted, several lawmakers in the room said. At the end of the day, the country needs a Speaker that can be relied upon, said Representative Adam Schiff of California. We don't trust him. Their members don't trust him, and you need a certain degree of trust to be the Speaker. Typically, top party leaders would be next in line for the job, but Majority Leader Steve Scalise is battling cancer, and Majority Whip Tom Emmer, like any potential candidate, may have trouble securing the vote. No matter who is going to be the Speaker, the challenges still remain, Scalise said, but I think the opportunity is there to continue moving forward. It took McCarthy 15 rounds in January over multiple days of voting to gain the gavel. Republicans left the chamber in a daze on Tuesday, uncertain about next steps. I honestly don't know, said Representative Debbie Lesko, a Republican from Arizona. This is a total disaster. Also on the front page, an article entitled Poll, College Campuses More Open to Liberals' Free Speech. Americans view college campuses as far friendlier to liberals than to conservatives when it comes to free speech, with adults across the political spectrum seeing less tolerance for those on the right, according to a new poll. Overall, 47% of adults say liberals have a lot of freedom to express their views on college campuses, while just 20% said the same of conservatives, according to polling from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research and the University of Chicago Forum for Free Inquiry and Expression. Republicans perceive a stronger bias on campuses against conservatives, but Democrats see a difference too. About 4 in 10 Democrats say liberals can speak their minds freely on campuses, while about 3 in 10 Democrats say conservatives can do so. If you're a Republican or lean Republican, you're unabashedly wrong. They shut you down, said Rhonda Baker, 60, of Goldsboro, North Carolina, who voted for former President Donald Trump and has a son in college. If they hold a rally, it's the MAGA's coming through. It's the KKK is coming through. Debates over First Amendment rights have occasionally flared on college campuses in recent years, with conflicts arising over guest speakers who express polarizing views, often from the political. Stanford University became a flashpoint this year when students shouted down a conservative judge who was invited to speak. More recently, a conservative Princeton University professor was drowned out while discussing free speech at Washington College, a small school in Maryland. At the same time, Republican lawmakers in dozens of states have proposed bills aiming to limit public colleges from teaching topics considered divisive or liberal. Just 30% of Americans say states should be able to restrict what professors at state universities teach, the poll found, though support was higher among Republicans. Overall, Republicans see a clear double standard on college campuses. Just 9% said conservatives can speak their minds, while 58% said liberals have that freedom, according to the polling. They were also slightly less likely than Americans overall to see campuses as respectful and inclusive places for conservatives. Chris Govan, a Republican who has done construction work on campuses, believes conservative voices are stifled. While working at Yale University, he was once stopped by pro-LGBTQ+ activists who asked for his opinion, he said. They asked me how I felt, so I figured I'd tell them. I spoke in a normal tone. I didn't get excited or upset, said Govan, 58, of Manchester, Connecticut. But it proceeded with 18 to 20 people who were suddenly very irritated and agitated. It just exploded. He took a lesson from the experience. I learned to be very quiet there. Republicans in Congress have raised alarms with a recent House report warning of the long-standing and pervasive degradation of First Amendment rights at U.S. colleges. Some in the GOP have called for federal legislation requiring colleges to protect free speech and punish those who infringe on others' rights. Nicholas Fleischer, who chairs an academic freedom committee for the American Association of University Professors, said public perception is skewed by the infrequent cases when protesters go too far. The reality is that there's free speech for everyone on college campuses, said Fleischer, a linguistics professor at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. In conversations within classrooms, people are free to speak their minds, and they do. Officials at PEN America, a free speech group, say most students welcome diverse views. But as the nation has become more politically divided, so have college campuses, said Kristen Chavardilian, senior manager for education at PEN. There's this polarization that just continues to grow and build across our country, and colleges and universities are a part of that ecosystem, she said. Morgan Ashford, a Democrat in an online graduate program at Troy University in Alabama, said she thinks people can express themselves freely on campus, regardless of politics or skin color. Still, she sees a lack of tolerance for the LGBTQ+ community in her Republican state, where the governor has passed anti-LGBTQ legislation. I think there have to be guidelines around hate speech, said Ashford, because some people can go overboard. When it comes to protesting speakers, most Americans say it should be peaceful. About 8 in 10 say it's acceptable to engage in peaceful, non-disruptive protest at a campus event, while just 15% say it's okay to prevent a speaker from communicating with the audience, the poll found. If they don't like it, they can get up and walk out, said Linda Woodward, 71, a Democrat in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Mike Darlington, a real estate appraiser who votes Republican, said drowning out speakers violates the virtues of a free society. Seems to me a very, very selfish attitude that makes students think, if you don't think the way I do, then your thoughts are unacceptable, said Darlington, 58, of Chesterfield County, Virginia. The protest at Stanford was one of six campus speeches across the U.S. that ended in significant disruption this year, with another 11 last year, according to a database by the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a free speech group. Those cases, while troubling, are one symptom of a broader problem, said Ilya Shapiro, a conservative legal scholar who was shouted down during a speech last year at the University of California Law School. He says colleges have drifted away from the classic ideal of academia as a place for free inquiry. An even bigger problem than speakers being disrupted by protesters is students and faculty feeling that they can't be open in their views. They can't even discuss certain subjects, said Shapiro, director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute think tank. In national and world news, an article regarding the Trump fraud trial headlined, Judge Issues a Gag Order. The former president made comments about a clerk on social media. Rebuking Donald Trump, a state court judge imposed a limited gag order Tuesday in the former president's civil business fraud trial and ordered him to delete a social media post that publicly maligned a key court staffer. Judge Arthur Engoron told all participants in the case not to smear court personnel, warning of serious sanctions if they do. Personal attacks on members of my court staff are unacceptable, not appropriate, and I will not tolerate them, Engoron said after complaining, without naming names, about a defendant's disparaging, untrue, and personally identifying post about a member of my staff. A few hours earlier, Trump posted a photo of Engoron's principal law clerk, Allison Greenfield, posing with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, at a public event. Trump, the Republican frontrunner for president in 2024, repeatedly cast the trial as a political attack by New York's Democratic Attorney General, Letitia James. Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform that it was disgraceful that Greenfield was working with the judge in the courtroom, adding to complaints he made outside court on Monday. The post apparently sparked a series of closed-door courtroom discussions involving Trump and lawyers for both sides during what's usually a lunch break. By the time the gag order was issued, Trump deleted the post, as Engoron ordered, according to the judge. A Schumer spokesperson called the post pathetic. They said the senator doesn't know Greenfield and is in photos with thousands of constituents. Aside from that sideshow, James' attorney questioned an accountant Tuesday to build the state's case that Trump and others at his company had full control over the preparation of misleading and false financial statements at the heart of their case. The state's lawsuit alleges that Trump and his business chronically lied about his wealth on financial statements given to banks, insurers, and others. Trump and lawyers have said his financial statements were legitimate representations of the worth of unique luxury properties, made even more valuable because of their association with him. The defense also emphasizes that the financial statements bore disclaimers, saying that they weren't audited and that others might reach different conclusions about his financial position if they had more information. We have an article from Delaware entitled Hunter Biden Pleads Not Guilty. A plea deal on federal gun charges collapsed. Case could go to trial. Hunter Biden pleaded not guilty Tuesday to three federal firearms charges filed after his earlier deal imploded, setting the case on track toward a possible trial in 2024 while his father campaigns for re-election. President Joe Biden's son was charged with lying about his drug use in October 2018 on a form to buy a gun that he kept for about 11 days. He could face up to 25 years in prison if convicted. When asked by Magistrate Judge Christopher Burke if he understood the charges against him, he said, "Yes, Your Honor." His lawyer, Abby Lowell, said in court he plans to file a motion to dismiss the charges, challenging their constitutionality. Hunter Biden has acknowledged struggling with an addiction to crack cocaine during that period in 2018, but his lawyers have said he didn't break the law. Cases like this against drug users accused of having guns are rare, and an appeals court found the underlying statute violates the Second Amendment under new Supreme Court standards. On Tuesday, the judge noted Hunter Biden was repeatedly tested for drugs and is negative. Hunter Biden's attorneys suggested prosecutors bowed to pressure by Republicans who insisted the Democratic president's son got a sweetheart deal and that the charges were the result of political pressure. President Trump and his MAGA allies have forced the Justice Department to ignore the law and deviate from its policies in cases like this one, Lowell said in a statement. Hunter Biden left the courthouse shortly after the hearing. The pretrial release conditions include no alcohol or drugs, drug testing or substance abuse counseling if needed, and continuing or seeking employment. This summer, Hunter Biden agreed to plead guilty to misdemeanor tax charges and would have also avoided prosecution on the gun charges had he stayed out of trouble for 2 years. It was the culmination of a years-long investigation by federal prosecutors into the business dealings of the president's son, and the agreement would have dispensed with criminal proceedings and spared the Bidens weeks of headlines as the election loomed. And speaking of the Bidens, we have an article entitled "Biden Tries to Reassure Allies on Aid for Ukraine." U.S. convenes call after Congress leaves out funds for Kyiv in bill. President Joe Biden gathered other world powers Tuesday to coordinate on Ukraine as it battles Russia in a war that has been going on nearly 20 months, a deliberate show of U.S. support at a time when the future of its aid is entangled with a volatile faction of the House of Representatives who want to cut off money to Kyiv. The phone call, convened by the United States and joined by key allies in Europe, as well as the leaders of Canada and Japan, was held 3 days after Biden signed legislation Congress hastily sent to him that kept the U.S. federal government funded, but left out billions in funding for Ukraine's war effort that the White House vigorously backed. All the countries that participated in the call stressed that their backing of Ukraine remains unchanged, and no one questioned whether U.S. support of Kyiv was in doubt, according to the White House. However, the administration sternly warned Tuesday that Congress must not let the flow of aid be disrupted, lest Russian President Vladimir Putin exploit any lapses to his advantage. And now to the dispute between India and Canada. Article entitled, "India Orders Canada to Remove 41 Diplomats." The countries are at odds over accusations about Sikh separatist killing. India told Canada to remove 41 of its 62 diplomats in the country, an official familiar with the matter said Tuesday, ramping up a confrontation between the two countries over Canadian accusations that India may have been involved in the killing of a Sikh separatist leader in suburban Vancouver. The official who confirmed an earlier report from the Financial Times spoke on condition of anonymity. India's Ministry of External Affairs declined to comment, but ministry spokesperson Arindam Bagchi previously called for a reduction in Canada's diplomats in India, saying they outnumbered India's staffing in Canada. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said last month that there were credible allegations of Indian involvement in the slaying of Ardeep Singh Nijjar, a 45-year-old Sikh leader who was killed by masked gunmen in June in Surrey outside Vancouver. For years, India and Nijjar said Nijjar, a Canadian citizen born in India, has links to terrorism, an allegation Nijjar denied. Arranging the killing of a Canadian citizen in Canada, home to nearly 2 million people of Indian descent, would be unprecedented. And now a digest of national and world news. The FDA approves COVID-19 vaccine from Novavax. The U.S. regulators on Tuesday authorized another option for fall COVID-19 vaccination. Updated vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna began rolling out last month for adults and children 6 months old and up. Now the Food and Drug Administration added another choice, reformulated Novavax shots open to anyone age 12 and older. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urged most Americans to get a fall COVID-19 vaccination, shots tweaked to protect against a newer coronavirus strain. Novavax said the shots will be available in the coming days. Novavax makes a protein-based vaccine mixed with an immune-boosting chemical, a different technology than the so-called mRNA vaccines made by Pfizer and Moderna. Next, an article entitled Supreme Court Seems Likely to Back CFPB, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. The Supreme Court on Tuesday seemed likely to preserve the work of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau against a conservative-led challenge. Even some conservative justices sounded skeptical of arguments that the agency created after the 2008 financial crisis to regulate mortgages, car loans, and other consumer finance violates the Constitution. It is funded directly by the Federal Reserve, with an annual limit of about $600 million, rather than by the annual budget process in Congress. Republicans and their financial backers have long opposed the CFPB, the brainchild of Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts. Still, a majority of the court appeared ready to reject arguments of the lawyer for payday lenders who challenged a CFPB rule in the case. A ruling for the agency would quiet concerns about the validity of the CFPB's actions since its creation. And now a few brief comments on fentanyl. The Biden administration took aim Tuesday at the fentanyl trafficking threat, announcing a series of indictments and sanctions against Chinese companies and executives blamed for importing the chemicals used to make the deadly drug. School shooting. James and Jennifer Crumley, accused of making a gun accessible to and ignoring the mental health needs of their son, Ethan Crumley, who killed four students at a Michigan high school, lost an appeal Tuesday and will face trial on involuntary manslaughter charges. Census. The U.S. Census Bureau staffers valiantly conducted the 2020 census during the COVID-19 pandemic, but new privacy protocols to protect participants' confidentiality degraded the data, according to a report released on Tuesday. On debates, Donald Trump's campaign late Monday called on the Republican National Committee to cancel all remaining presidential primary debates after he skipped the first two. The campaign said the Republican National Committee must instead focus on defeating Joe Biden. On drug prices, President Joe Biden said on Tuesday the manufacturers of the first 10 prescription drugs selected for Medicare's first price negotiations agreed to participate, clearing the way for talks that could lower their costs. And from the Senate, Democratic insider and former union leader LaFonza Butler was sworn into the Senate on Tuesday, replacing California Senator Dianne Feinstein after her death. Butler is only the third black female senator in U.S. history. It's baseball season, and the wild card games are underway. In the American League, the Rangers defeat the sloppy Rays, St. Petersburg, Florida. Jordan Montgomery scattered six hits over seven innings, helping the Texas Rangers beat the sloppy Tampa Bay Rays 4-0 Tuesday in their American League Wild Card Series opener. Corey Seager and Josh Jung drove in runs, and the Rangers benefited from four errors by the Rays, who fizzled offensively before a crowd of just 19,704. Roughly 5,300 below listed capacity at Tropicana Field. Tampa Bay, wearing throwback Devil Rays jerseys in the style of 1998 to 2000, lost its sixth straight postseason game since winning its 2021 Division Series opener against Boston. The Rays have reached the postseason for the fifth straight season, but have one run in their last three playoff defeats. Montgomery, a 30-year-old left-hander acquired from St. Louis at the trade deadline, retired 14 of his last 16 batters. He fanned pinch hitter Junior Caminero Tampa Bay's top minor league prospect, to end his outing with 5 strikeouts and no walks. Aroldis Chapman pitched a perfect 8th, and Jose Leclerc worked around a walk in the 9th to finish a 6-hitter. The Rangers' first postseason shutout since the 2011 World Series. Tyler Glasnow yielded a sacrifice fly to Young in the 2nd, and his wild pitch allowed Texas to score its 2nd run after the Rangers loaded the bases in the 5th. Texas won for 6 with runners in scoring position while stranding 9 base runners through 5 innings, opened a 4-0 lead in the 6th with help from the normally sure-handed Rays, who committed 4 errors, Tampa Bay's most in a postseason game since 2008. Elsewhere, the Twins 3, Blue Jays 1. Royce Lewis smashed Minnesota's 18-game postseason losing streak into the seats, homering in each of his first 2 at-bats to carry the Twins over visiting Toronto in the opener of their AL wildcard series. Lewis hit a 2-run shot off Kevin Gausman in the 1st and a leadoff drive in the 3rd, sending the home dugout and the sellout Target Field crowd into a frenzy. The bigger celebration occurred a few hours later when Jean Duran pitched a hitless 9th to close the first victory in the playoffs for the Twins since October 5, 2004. They had the longest postseason losing streak in the major North American professional sports. It was the first home win for the Twins in the playoffs since Game 1 of the ALCS in 2002 at the Metrodome. Lewis was a 3-year-old then. He's the type of big-time player with 5 grand slams in 70 career games that could lead the Twins out of an actual postseason run instead of just hanging a division title banner and leaving the party after a few days. Pablo Lopez also delivered a strong playoff debut for Minnesota, permitting 1 run and 5 hits in 5 2/3 innings. He wore a Johan Santana jersey to the ballpark, a nod to not only his Venezuelan boyhood hero, but the last Twins pitcher to win a postseason game. Gausman's day for the Blue Jays was more bumpy, finishing in 4 innings with 3 hits and 3 walks. The right-hander frequently asked for a new ball early in his outing and had trouble at one point with his PitchCom device. Gausman had only 1 start shorter than this in 2023. Switching over to the National League Wild Card Series, the D-backs hit Burns hard and rally past the Brewers. Corbin Carroll, Ketel Marte, and Gabriel Moreno homered against Corbin Burns, helping erase an early 3-run deficit and sending the Arizona Diamondbacks to a 6-3 victory over the Milwaukee Brewers in Game 1 of their NL Wild Card Series on Tuesday night. The rally put Arizona in a prime position to advance. Game 2 of the best-of-3 series is Wednesday, and the Diamondbacks have ace Zach Gallen and Merrill Kelly lined up after rookie Brendan Pfaadt lasted just 2 2/3 innings in the opener. Arizona, which clinched an NL wild card in the final days of the season, had been 0-14 in postseason games when trailing by at least 3 runs. Carroll and Marte homered on back-to-back pitches in the 3rd, and Moreno put the Diamondbacks ahead in the 4th. Even Longoria protected Arizona's 1-run lead in the 5th by robbing Tyrone Taylor of a bases-loaded hit and turning it into an inning-ending double play. Christian Walker provided some insurance with a 2-run double off Devin Williams in the 9th. The NL Central champion Brewers left the bases loaded in the 1st and 3rd, and they failed to score after loading the bases with nobody out in the 5th. Arizona's Joe Mantiply, Miguel Castro, Ryan Nelson, Ryan Thompson, Kevin Ginkle, and Paul Sewald combined for 6 1/3 innings of shutout relief. Milwaukee appeared to have a starting pitching advantage for Game 1 by virtue of clinching its playoff berth early enough to set up its postseason rotation. It didn't quite work out that way. Although Fott yielded 3 runs and 7 hits before departing in the third, Burns also struggled. The 3-time All-Star and 2021 Cy Young Award winner allowed 4 runs through the first 4 innings and left with the Brewers trailing 4-3 after he walked 2 batters in the 5th. As between the Phillies and the Phillies 4 runs, the Marlins 1. Zach Wheeler struck out 8 and pitched into the 7th to lead Philadelphia over visiting Miami. Christian Pasch and Bryson Stott had run-scoring singles for the Phillies. Alec Bohm and Nick Castellanos added RBI doubles. Reliever Jose Alvarado struck out Yuli Gurriel with 2 runners on in the 7th to end a threat. Craig Kimbrell worked a scoreless 9th. The Phillies won 11 postseason games last season, 2 shy of the ultimate goal and their first World Series title since 2008. First baseman Reese Hoskins, who tore the ACL in his left knee and has not played this season, threw out the first pitch. In the world of football, we have an article entitled "A Sack Full of Trouble." The Giants show very little in a loss to the Seahawks. If there is any image that should stick in the minds of the New York Giants after being thoroughly beaten by the Seattle Seahawks on Monday night, it's the sight of quarterback Daniel Jones being sacked 10 times. Seemingly every time the $160 million quarterback went back to pass, there was a white shirt or two in his face, forcing him to either run, get rid of the ball, or hold it, as he was sent repeatedly to the turf in the Seahawks' 24-3 win at MetLife Stadium. Seattle tied a franchise record with 11 sacks, but one of those was recorded against receiver Paris Campbell on a trick play where he was going to throw a pass. "I mean, give credit to their defense," Jones said after another inept performance by New York's offense. "They rush hard and play well together, but I've got to do a better job getting through my reads, getting the ball out of my hand, and making quick decisions, so I'll definitely look to work on that." If there was one play Jones would like to have back, it was a pass to Campbell near the goal line late in the third quarter. Facing a second and goal at the Seahawks' 5, Jones and Campbell weren't on the same page. The pass was intercepted by rookie cornerback Devin Witherspoon and returned 97 yards for a touchdown and a 21-3 lead. Had New York 1-3 scored a touchdown on the series, it's 14-10 with a quarter to play, and it's a different ball game. Instead, it was game over, and Giants fans headed for the exits for the second straight home game. They also left early in the 40-0 loss to Dallas on September 10. "I just felt like the coverage was soft, trying to find someone in the zone, and yeah, obviously, terrible decision and awful mistake. So I can't afford to do that," said Jones, who finished 27 of 34 for 203 yards. Having star running back Saquon Barkley sidelined by a sprained right ankle for 2 weeks also has not helped. Part of the problem for the Giants is that star left tackle Andrew Thomas, has missed the past 3 games with a hamstring injury, and the line had 4 different starting combinations in 4 games. Only rookie center John Michael Schmitz and right tackle Evan Neal have started all 4 games at the same position. Schmitz left in the first half Monday with a shoulder injury, but he said he was fine after the game. "We take responsibility for those 11 sacks," Neal said. "There is no excuse whatever. We come in to work every day and try to put our best foot forward. In other NFL notes, on the Jets, Zach Wilson proved the trust Robert Saleh and the team had in him was deserved. Dissed publicly, dragged online, and disrespected by everyone from Broadway Joe to almost every former player turned talking head, Wilson responded by outplaying Patrick Mahomes on Sunday Night Football, only to come up short after losing a fumble in the fourth quarter. There are no moral victories in sports, but Wilson's performance in New York's 23-20 loss to the defending Super Bowl champion Chiefs was a major positive for a team still reeling from losing Aaron Rodgers in the season opener. The Pittsburgh Steelers' Pittsburgh coach Mike Tomlin said his team needs to up its physicality after Sunday's loss to Houston. Tomlin said he plans to have his team practice in pads before facing Baltimore after opting to practice in helmets in recent weeks because of its compacted schedule. Steelers quarterback Kenny Pickett will practice while dealing with a bone bruise in his left knee. The Lions, after serving a four-game suspension for gambling, wide receiver Jameson Williams is fired up to get his season started when Detroit hosts Carolina on Sunday. While the coaches have not said if he will be active, Williams expects to play. Williams was able to return to practice this week after the NFL revised its gambling policy last week. On the Patriots, edge rusher Matt Judon has elected to have surgery to repair a torn bicep, according to an AP source. Judon is scheduled to have a procedure on Wednesday and be out indefinitely. ESPN first reported Judon's decision. Judon suffered the injury in the fourth quarter of New England's loss to Dallas last week. On the Packers, Green Bay's beleaguered and beaten-up offensive line could get an enormous boost for Monday night's game at Las Vegas. Left guard Elgon Jenkins practiced on Tuesday as the team returned from a break following its Thursday night loss to Detroit. Jenkins has missed the Packers' last two games with a sprained medial collateral ligament. Packers cornerback Eric Stokes also practiced Tuesday in his return from a foot injury that ended his 2022 season. And now a look at an article from the NBA. We'll talk basketball. New rest rules don't bother NBA players. With new policies and penalties, the NBA has made it clear that healthy players should be on the court. No argument from the players, who insist they aren't interested in sitting. Some don't like load management any more than the fans, who wonder why some of the best athletes in the world so often need a night off. But they also want the league to understand that there are times, quite a few of them during Kawhi Leonard's lone season in Toronto, when they have to listen to their bodies or their doctors. "I was coming from an injury, and you have to know the details of the doctor," Leonard, now with the Los Angeles Clippers, said Monday. "But if the league is seeing or trying to mock what I did with the Raptors, they should stop, because I was injured the whole year. But other than that, if I'm able to play, I'll play basketball. I'll work out every day in the summertime to play the game, not to sit and watch people play. No league policy is helping me to play more games." Some of Leonard's absences in the recent years are the type the NBA is looking to eliminate with its player participation policy that takes effect this season. He missed 22 games in the 2018-2019 as the Raptors were careful to avoid overuse after he returned from a thigh injury that limited him to 9 games the previous season. The league believes those scheduled nights off, known as load management, have become too common and potentially damaging if they drive away viewers. "I think the league is trying to figure out ways to make our game better, to help grow the game, understanding that fan engagement is important for all of us," said New Orleans guard C.J. McCollum, the president of the Players Association. As a fan of sports, when you go to a game, you want the stars to play. You are paying a premium on the ticket, or maybe it's the cable package or whatever you have. You want to see the best players play. The policy prevents teams without approval from resting multiple star players, defined as anyone who was an All-NBA or All-Star selection in the prior three seasons, in the same game, or sitting healthy ones in nationally televised or in-season tournament games. The league threatened to investigate certain absences with penalties that would surpass $1 million if a team has three violations. Obviously, the NBA is always trying to find a way to get the best players playing. And why? Well, because we want people to tune in to their TVs and watch, said Michael Malone, coach of the NBA champion Denver Nuggets, and they're going to watch when the best players show up every night and play. That has happened far too infrequently in recent years. Even as the league has reduced back-to-back games from team schedules and limited and improved their travel, some top players rarely come close to 82 games. Players bear the brunt of the criticism from fans, even though Commissioner Adam Silver has said it's often the teams deciding when they will be rested. I think the league's approach in trying to get players to play more often, I think that's great. I'm trying to play as many games as I possibly can, Boston's Jaylen Brown said. Another new policy is directed more toward them. The new collective bargaining agreement requires players, in most instances, to play in 65 regular season games to be eligible for awards such as MVP or the All-NBA teams. I think there are guys across the league that may sit out because they don't want to play or they want to rest or whatever it is. But I think playing a minimum of 65 games, I think that's smart for the league, for the fans, for everybody. Miami's Tyler Herro said, "This is a business at the end of the day. A lot of people come to watch us play. I wouldn't want to be a fan that came to see me play and I'm not playing because I don't want to." And we'll end with an article on nutrition called Getting It Right with Corn and Mushrooms. Responding to a recent column about fresh corn, reader Al W. from Dallas writes, "Having grown up on a farm, I take exception with some of your cob/ear terminology. You wrote, what a treat to walk up and down rows of green corn stalks, searching for just the right cob to pick. You should have used ear instead of cob. One picks an ear of corn. I also misstated that we, quote, dip the cobs in boiling water, and that a cob of corn has about 30 grams of carbohydrates. I doubt that a cob would have 30 grams of carbohydrates or much nutrition at all," reader Al continued. He's right. According to agricultural publisher Crop for Life, a corn's, quote, cob, close quote, is the long cylindrical structure that is attached to the stem of the corn plant and is covered with kernels, the corn seeds. The ear includes the outer green husk as well as the cob and the kernels. So we pick an ear of corn and eat the kernels off the cob, right? Thanks for pointing this out, Al. Dave from Arizona asks, "I've read that in order to derive the full nutritional value from mushrooms, they should be nuked in the microwave for 2 to 3 minutes. Is this true? And are there other vegetables that should be cooked in any way? It appears to depend on which type of mushrooms you are testing, Dave." A 2016 study by Spanish researchers in the International Journal of Food Sciences and Nutrition tested the nutrient effects of various cooking methods on shiitake, white button, and oyster mushrooms. The mushrooms lost more protein when they were fried and boiled than when they were microwaved or grilled. In fact, microwaved or grilled mushrooms maintained their nutrient values along with increased levels of healthful antioxidant substances. Another study published in Food Science and Nutrition in 2017 found somewhat different results with another type of mushroom grown in Africa, the Amanita zambiana. These researchers found that frying as well as microwaving mushrooms enhanced their protein and antioxidant content. Among the tested cooking methods, they concluded that the best method of cooking mushrooms that retains or enhances nutritional benefits is frying, followed by microwaving. Here are a couple of other interesting facts about mushrooms. They are neither plants nor animals, said the Mushroom Council. Rather, they are part of the fungi kingdom, along with yeasts and molds. Still, edible mushrooms are categorized as vegetables in the latest 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. That's due to their similarity nutrition-wise to this food group. In regard to your other question about vegetables that should be cooked in any way, I will save this for a future column. Thanks for writing.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.